Good morning, all. The first case for argument this morning is Griffin versus Foley. Mr. Morisi?
May it please the court. Good morning, Your Honors. I'd like to thank the court for allowing the parties oral argument in this case. As the court knows, the court doesn't want facts discussed. The court knows the facts. But the facts are intertwined with the procedural anomalies with this case, so the court would grant me a little leave to mention facts. In Indiana, as the court knows, it goes through the medical malpractice panel before it can go to the court. As the plaintiff's counsel in this case, I filed this case in the United States Federal District Court because of the rules and the procedures that I thought protected all litigants. When this case started, Lisa Griffin was 38 years old. She's now a grandmother. We have disabled on hard pain medicine, and we have alleged multiple acts of medical malpractice, as the court knows. With regard to the defendant's appellee's brief, the defendant has not disputed any of the holdings in any of the cases cited by the plaintiff. I think the court will find that. And the cases that they have cited, in the main, predate the changes in the rules of federal procedure, particularly Rule 26A2B and Rule 51D2, which are covered well in our brief. The first area I want to get into is the modifying of a scheduling order, such as the designations of expert witnesses. The defendant pled for excusable neck and the widened definition from our Supreme Court in Pioneer versus Brunswick. As the court well knows, that widened the definition of excusable neglect. But nowhere in the rules of federal procedure or in the case law is there any allowance for conscious disregard of the rules of federal procedures. Here, the defendant in his brief says that they made a conscious decision not to file for an extension. I think the court should strongly consider that. With regard to depositions in this case, the magistrate judge allowed for a so-called discovery deposition and an evidence deposition. The plaintiffs have always believed that the defendants were entitled to discovery. We submitted detailed Rule 26A2B reports. What we do dispute is that the court and the defendant's assertion that we couldn't use the depositions, the discovery depositions, in our case. And, of course, we cite multiple cases on that. Now, this lady came into my office in April of 1998. She had an attempted spine fusion with a substance called coral reef and a little of her own bone. Coral reef is also known by the brand name Proosteon. She came in with expert opinion stating that this substance was not to be used to affect a spinal fusion. And so when we filed this case before the Department of Insurance in 1998, even though Indiana and the federal courts do not require fact pleading, the plaintiff pled facts. And we said that this substance, coral reef, Proosteon, had no value in affecting a spine fusion.
What is it for? Is it a bone filler?
It's a bone filler. It was licensed as a bone filler at the time the surgery was performed in 1994, just to fill holes in bones. And that's the current status of its license at this time. Now, we asked the defendant in answers in interrogatories, please, you know, maybe we're wrong, produce some scientific material that justifies the use of this substance. We asked him in his deposition in 2002 in the Indiana administrative case whether or not he could produce any learned treatise or scientific articles that justified the use of this substance the way he did. He produced about 25 pages of anecdotal material, none of them in peer-reviewed journals, no material that justified the use of this.
Anecdotal, you mean what other doctors have done or what?
Oh, it was anecdotal. It was advertisements from the company, stuff in trade publications, trade newspapers. There was no peer-reviewed journal produced in 2002. So we thought we had a great exclusionary issue. We thought that this would be the center of a Daubert motion to keep all of this evidence out, move the case along, and affect a result for our clients. We thought this was a bright line deviation, that he had crossed the center line, collided with the on. It was not a judgment call. Now, so 60 days before trial, we filed a 702, 703 motion. We've called it 702, we've called it 703, but it's a Daubert motion. And under we filed the Daubert motion after their only expert in this case disclosed his opinions in his Rule 26A2B report. Now, that opinion states, with regard to the bone grafting, this is the total sum of his opinion.
The Sasso?
Sasso, Rick Sasso. Dr. Foley used local bone graft with Proosteon as a bone extender. This is a well-recognized technique. It is not experimental, as the experts contend. And then he makes a comment on our expert. Proosteon is not allograft bone. It is not a bone graft substitute. It is used appropriately, as Foley did, with autogenous bone to extend effects over more spinal levels. That was the total extent of his disclosure. So, based upon that disclosure, which doesn't provide any detailed information, it's merely a conclusory statement. No methodology, no learned treatise, no citations, no clinical data to support the efficacy of coral reef in this substance, no reference to any or many scientific articles. So, boy, we thought we had them. Filed the Rule 702, 703 motion and waited for their response. 16 days went by, and they said, well, they couldn't respond because they were waiting for the Rule 26A2B reports from the panelists. The panelists never provided reports. And they claimed that the case management order said that that we agreed that the panelists wouldn't have to file a Rule 26A2B report. The case management order states as follows, and it was amended by them without our total approval. The defendant shall disclose the name, address, and vita of all retained expert witnesses, not including the medical review panel, and shall serve the report required by Rule 26A2B. Now, we didn't need to know the names and address of the panelists, so that was appropriate. But we needed their reports. The statutory report in Indiana after the panel renders its decision is that there's no violation of the standard of care. That's all we had from the panelists.
Is that unusual? I don't know how this Indiana panel works, but
no, it's not unusual.
No,
that's standard. That's
given,
prescribed by statute, Your Honor.
It's just a bottom-line decision.
Just a bottom-line decision with no basis, nothing there.
So this was, am I right, about 4 or 5 years that it was pending and that...
Yes, 5 years it was pending. Yes.
And then,
the panels are very slow, Your Honor.
Tell me how that panel is constituted.
Okay, generally speaking, the plaintiff names a doctor, the defendant names a doctor. And then they strike them. Well, and most of these panels, if I pick somebody out of the phone book and give that name to the panel chair who's an attorney, the defendant will strike them. I just pick names out of the phone book, and the defendant always strikes them. I mean, I don't have any in with anybody in Indiana.
Well, how do they get the third person?
Well, what happens is then the panel chair picks a so-called striking panel, Your Honor. So the panel chair is picked the whole panel.
Well, I imagine that there could be challenges within Indiana to how these panels are constituted, but that's not an issue.
That's not an issue in this case.
We can be concerned with. But is it? I'm just curious as to whether this is a usual procedure where a complaint is filed and 5 years or so pass, and then you just get a one sentence. Thumbs up, thumbs down decision.
I'm trying to save my argument time, Your Honor. There was a question of statute of limitations that went up to the appellate court. The appellate court refused to rule it. In Indiana, the statute of limitations is told if there's continuing negligence. We alleged continuing negligence within 2 years of our filing our complaint before the Indiana Department of Insurance. So that delayed it about a year and a half. But they are slow, Your Honor. And the panels won't meet. The doctors don't cooperate with the panel chairman. That's not part of this record. I'm sorry,
Isn't your main focus of this whole thing, and you're really contesting the judge's procedure and allowing a lot of things to happen that you think shouldn't have?
That's right. The rules of civil procedure were rewritten by the Southern District there, Your Honor. And the case management plan was revised unilaterally. And I'm going to run out of time. The district court allowed the defendant to file their Rule 702 and 703 motions within 10 days of trial. Post-trial discovery. Now, I read to you the opinion of Dr. Sasso.
It was 6 months. I mean, you got a continuance, and then 6 months later, the trial.
But all of the rulings that we were prejudiced by were already fixed in stone, Your Honor. Now, when before Sasso testified, we filed a motion in limine that he's not, since they didn't produce any learned treatise during the course of the trial, they couldn't say that there were many documents, many scientific articles justifying the use of this stuff, and they couldn't produce any at trial because they never produced any for 8 years. So the judge overruled our motion in limine. Sasso gets up on the stand, and he makes it up, Your Honors. He lies. He commits perjury. He's the big spinal expert from Indianapolis, and he can say anything, and no one will question him. He stated that there were many scientific articles justifying the use in this instance, and this stuff was not experimental. So we filed a post-trial subpoena, asking him to produce some of those articles, asking us to show how he's used this substance, because he led the court and the jury to believe that he had used this substance before. It's good for a hole in the bone. If you have a cyst in the bone, you can pack it with this stuff, and in 2 years it's resorbed. It's licensed for that. So I see I'm in my rebuttal time. The subpoena was quashed, and we were never able to get post-trial discovery.
Now, you did have, during the, I guess, your cross, you did bring up two things, and they followed up on this, and you objected to that, too, two documents that they said the judge said you opened the door for.
Right. That was when the defendant was on the stand. When the defendant was on the stand, we said, Doctor, isn't it true in the last 6 years, you never produced any peer review articles? He said, yes, that's true. The defendant spoke truthfully. So I was asking him about peer review articles, and they said I'd opened the door by asking him if there were any peer review articles. So then the judge, in redirect, allowed them to read those articles into the record.
Well, they said which ones, did he say on cross which ones they were or name them?
No.
Just said there were some.
Well, they were non-peer review articles. Well, they were the same anecdotal articles produced during the...
They weren't something you asked about specifically. Then.
No. No, Your Honor.
Dr. Maurice, before you sit down, I want to ask you about the instruction that you object to in this case.
Yes, Your Honor.
Now, you objected during closing argument, is that
yes, correct? Your Honor.
Had you previously not objected to that particular instruction?
We, during a jury conference that was not recorded, we objected to it, and the judge says, no, I'm going to give defendants, and we did not renew our objection, Your Honor.
Well, when you say not recorded, was there a point in time when the district judge memorialized the positions of the parties regarding the instructions before he gave them?
Yes, Your Honor. He asked if there's any objections, and we said no, Your Honor. We did say no. Now, the case out of this court is the Gordon versus Degelman, which says that no party may assign error in giving or the failure to give an instruction unless that a party objects thereto before the jury retires and considers its verdict. So regardless of the modifications of Rule 51D2, Your Honors, this court has said that if we object before the jury retires, it's still preserved. I'm out of time, Your Honor, unless you have questions.
Well, you have some rebuttal time left.
Yes, thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Dr. Maurice. Mr. Edwards.
May it please the court. My name is Clay Edwards, and I represent the appellee in this case, Dr. Robert Foley. I'm happy to address the issues raised by the appellant in his brief in the order in which they were raised, or I'm happy to address the issues in any order that the court would prefer. I'm happy to start with the issue of jury instructions, since that was the last issue that was just discussed for the court. I think this is a fairly straightforward issue. Plaintiffs in this case complained about three instructions, instructions 20, 21, and 22.
That number 22 was the one that said it can only consider the opinion of the orthopod.
That is correct, Your Honor. The instruction number 22 informed the jury that when considering expert testimony, they were to consider the testimony of other experts in the same class, or in this case, orthopedic surgeons.
And that was limited to orthopedic surgeons.
That is correct, Your Honor. And the reason for that instruction, which again, the appellant never objected to.
That was a proposed instruction, I assume, by you, because you had Dr. Sasso as an orthopedic surgeon as your expert witness.
Well, the reason we tendered that instruction, Your Honor, and I think this is made clear in the appendix, is word for word based on Indiana pattern instruction 2312. And in the Robertson versus Bond case, it makes clear that when considering whether or not a physician has deviated from the standard of care, the jury is to consider whether or not the physician acted as a reasonably prudent physician in the same class. For that reason, the term orthopedic surgeon was inserted, because my client is an orthopedic surgeon. So that instruction essentially tracked 2312, which is a pattern instruction. Now, when the court gave counsel for both parties the opportunity to object, contrary to the statement by Mr. Maurice, the plaintiffs actually did object. They objected to a statute of limitations instruction. They chose not to object to any other instructions, including 20, 21, and 22.
What was the procedure? Was there an informal conference which was subsequently memorialized?
There was an informal conference. The judge then came out and said, I have the packet. These are the instructions that we discussed and agreed upon. Are there any objections? He gave the counsel for the parties an opportunity to make a record. Plaintiff's counsel did object to a statute of limitations instruction, but did not object to any other instructions or any of the language in any of the other instructions.
Did the plaintiff object in the informal conference and then did not object in the when?
I must respectfully disagree with the plaintiff's counsel. My recollection of the informal conference is that we submitted different instructions, but I do not recall plaintiff's counsel.
That's why we don't really care about that.
Fair enough.
If the objection has to be on the record.
Right.
We would agree.
When it was put on the record, was there just this general approach that you described, Mr. Edwards, or did you go through each numbered instruction and get a response from both sides?
The court simply asked the parties if they had any objection to any of the instructions. And again, the only objection they had was for a statute of limitations instruction. It is also, I think, undisputed that even though they are now complaining about instructions 20 and 21, at no point, not even in closing argument, was there ever an objection to those instructions.
There's one doctor that testified who was not orthopedic, is that right?
That is correct. The plaintiffs in this case actually had two experts testify as opposed to the defendant's one. One of their experts was a neurosurgeon, and one of their experts was an orthopedic surgeon. Essentially, Your Honor, if you look at their brief, they basically are attempting to complain that they were denied the opportunity to have a fair trial because the trial court granted a motion for an extension in August of 2006. I mean, merely gave us an extension to respond to a motion filed in August of 2006 when we had a trial in April of 2007. They have not explained or pointed out to anyone exactly how granting us additional time could deny them the right to a fair trial.
Well, the trial date was a lot sooner than April at that point, wasn't it?
That is correct, Your Honor, and the trial was continued at the request of plaintiff's counsel.
That was when they got hit with the 10 motions in limine, right?
There were numerous motions pending before the court. Both sides filed numerous motions, and the court decided it would be better to give all parties additional time. The court was also coming out of a criminal trial at the time. But most importantly, in order for plaintiffs to prevail on this issue about motion for extension, the court has to believe that there was an abuse of discretion. This court has to believe that no reasonable trial judge could have granted us an extension, and we believe that under the circumstances, the plaintiffs cannot prove or meet that burden. In this case, the judge had just changed the case management plan to require the defendants to produce experts, reports from experts who are not retained experts, but rather medical review panel members. As a result of that new ruling, the court did give us additional time to respond to plaintiff's motion to bar testimony. So there was good cause for the extension that we were seeking. With respect to the issue of, there was some discussion about the cross-examination of Dr. Foley. And what happened in this case was that plaintiff's counsel chose to cross-examine Dr. Foley and to attempt to create an impression with the jury that Dr. Foley was unable to produce any information, and that's important, any information supporting the use of proostine 500 or this choline hydroxyapatite. Now, the problem with asking those questions in cross-examination is you then open the door and redirect. Because, in fact, Dr. Foley, in his discovery deposition in 2002, produced articles from Orthopedics Today and articles from the manufacturer of this product, of this substance, supporting its use. So when plaintiff's counsel cross-examines and attempts to create that impression with the jury, we are entitled, because the door has been opened to redirect, to bring that information out.
In cross-examination, did Dr. Foley mention those two, or did he just say that he had something?
He did not mention those two. There were different questions asked. There were questions asked about peer-reviewed materials, which are different than what he produced. But then they also cross-examined him about any information. And that's why we, during redirect, were able to show the jury that, in fact, he had produced information at his discovery deposition in 2002 at the request of plaintiff's counsel. Your Honor, with respect to the issue of the post-trial discovery, the court in this case quashed subpoenas that were issued after the trial had already taken place. I think that the courts that have addressed the issue of post-trial discovery have made very clear that it is to be extremely limited. There is a tremendous public interest in protecting the finality of judgment. In this case, it has been alleged that Dr. Sasso, who is the chair of spinal surgery at Indiana University, committed perjury. And I use the word alleged because although we have been told that Mr. Morisi has a good reason to believe that, there's never been any evidence of fraud or perjury brought either before the district court or before this court. There have been strong allegations, but there has been no evidence. And the district court recognized that in that situation, it is not proper to allow them to go forward after the trial with these subpoenas.
Pre-trial, weren't some of those documents requested, or wouldn't something similar have been done early on?
It certainly could have been, but it was not. Documents like that were never sought by plaintiff's counsel during the discovery phase of the case. And that is another one of the reasons why we felt like the district court was acting very appropriately in quashing the subpoenas after the fact. The final thing I would say about the subpoenas is that if Your Honors read those subpoenas, you will see that Mr. Morisi asked Dr. Sasso to produce operative reports over a 12-year period for several different procedures, which would require Dr. Sasso to go back and to review, to attempt to first locate and then to review every operative report over a 12-year period in an effort to determine what type of procedure was at issue and whether he used a certain substance. In addition to those requests, they also asked Dr. Sasso to produce any peer review literature in the entire world for the years 1994, 1995, 1996, 1997. I mean, these subpoenas were unduly burdensome, to say the very least. So for all those reasons, we feel that the court acted very appropriately in quashing the subpoenas.
Did he testify that this was a common usage for fusion operations?
Dr. Sasso testified that he, in fact, had used choline hydroxyapatite before as a bone graft extender, that while it was not, it was an FDA-approved substance, but it was an off-label use, which he testified is very common in spinal surgery and in many other types of medicine, and that it is perfectly within the standard of care to use this product in the manner in which Dr. Foley used it during the first surgery in this case.
Off-label means something other than a bone filler?
Correct. Off-label means using it in a manner for which it is not approved. It's very common in the United States. For instance, terbutaline is approved as an asthma medication. It's used every day to stop labor. Aspirin is actually not FDA approved as a blood thinner, but everyone uses it that way. Almost all of the chemotherapy medications are used in an off-label manner. The final issue, Your Honors, I would like to address is the issue with respect to the limitations on reading testimony and discovery deposition. The court made a very simple ruling in this case. The court said, plaintiff's attorney is allowed to ask his expert any questions he wants during the direct examination of his expert. What we're not going to allow you to do is then to reread the entire discovery deposition. So the plaintiffs in this case were not precluded from introducing any evidence or from asking any of the questions that they want from their experts. The court is merely saying, we're not going to read the direct examination and then go back and also allow you to reread portions of the discovery deposition or the entire discovery deposition. That is all the court did with that ruling. In fact,
the limitation, Mr. Edwards, on the use of the substance of the discovery depositions?
Well, the only limitation in this case, Your Honor, was that Mr. Morisi could ask any questions he wanted of his expert during direct examination. But he could not then, you know, essentially have the jury reread in total the discovery depositions or portions of the discovery depositions because it's cumulative.
No, I understand. Your position then is that any substantive matters covered in the discovery deposition was able to be addressed during the direct examination?
Absolutely. Plaintiff's counsel can ask any question that he wants. It's also significant for the court to understand that they called two experts at trial. Much has been made of this discovery deposition issue for Dr. Weiss, but they called two experts at trial that they could ask all these questions to. And we would disagree that Dr. Weiss was not allowed to testify about certain things. He testified at length, and that we've identified in our brief, I believe on page 48, all of the different subjects and topics that Dr. Weiss, in fact, did address. But we think it's also important to remember that Dr. Lieberson addressed all of the same things. So the important thing is that there has been no prejudice to the appellants because they were entitled to, and in fact did, introduce a tremendous amount of information from their experts. That's all I have for the court, unless there are any additional questions.
Thank you, Mr. Edwards.
Thank you, Your Honors.
All right. Ms. Maurice?
With regard to the jury instructions, the court admonished the parties not to make any more objections during final argument, so we only objected to the one instruction during the final argument. With regard to class of physicians, that refers to the Indiana law with regard a chiropractor testifying against a chiropractor, MD testifying an MD, not a neurosurgeon testifying against an orthopedic surgeon on spine when those specialties overlap when there's testimony in the record. No Daubert hearing was ever conducted on plaintiff's Rule 702, 703 motion. There was no good cause for any extension. with regard to the articles, we asked the defendant since 1998 to produce learned treatise so we would go away and save all this. If there were any justification for using that stuff, they never produced them. We asked the magistrate judge to bar for them to produce learned treatises. They never did. The magistrate judge correctly ruled that he has to produce some articles if he's going to discuss any at trial. So what Sasso did is says, oh, there are many articles when there were not. Now, so he never produced any and then was allowed in opposition to our motion in limine to say, oh, there are many articles. We asked that question. We moved for that production because we knew there were none. There are none today. The defendants in post-trial discovery produced two peer-review articles where proosteon was used as a bone filler, and it said all patients involved in that study, 2001 journal, learned treatise, journal article, said all patients were required to sign a release because proosteon was not licensed for use in the spine. They produced those articles. We never moved to strike them. They were long after discovery. And the proosteon was used as just a bone filler. With regard to the depositions, the magistrate judge issued an order that they were entitled to their discovery deposition, and then the magistrate judge says the parties are free to go back and examine and cross-examine the witnesses as they see fit. So when we were taking the deposition, the second deposition of plaintiff's expert, Dr. Weiss, Mr. Edwards refused to let me go first and questioned the witness on direct, and then the court struck all my redirect. Right. Thank you, Your Honor.
Before you go, I just want to ask one question. You obviously made a pretty strong search for any of these. Did you ever find any articles that said negatively you can't use it or should not use it?
No, we didn't. And they lament that our experts never produced any articles. The reason why they didn't is because there was none, and there still is none, as far as I know. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you, Mr. Bracey. Thanks to Mr. Edwards, co-counsel. We appreciate the arguments and the